with our longer pieces that will either be on the website or in our archives or the Google Docs, if we can state how long it is, that is, how many pages, and for the longer documents, if there could be a short paragraph describing the subject matter, which goes beyond the title, that would be helpful in gauging, number one, gauging what amount of time you have to set aside to read the document, and the clarification of the subject matter would be helpful for referring back, et cetera, over.
Yes. Again, we need a librarian, I think.
Oh, that's what I was going to talk about. I reorganized a lot of the stuff on the Google Docs site today because some of them were documents that we were finished reviewing and should have been put in a different file, and I've refiled and renamed some of them so that you can tell more clearly what they are or where they are and so on. So,
Great.
Anyway, I did work on that. I know Dennis had talked about being a librarian.
Yeah.
Do you remember that, Janice?
Yes, I do. I remember committing to help with the bibliography, but since Kevin is kind of making this for Texas as well, I really am tempted to jump in and help with that a lot.
Okay.
And, you know, write abstracts and all that kind of stuff, because I really need the knowledge anyway, because I'm really going to be, like, working the heck out of this thing. So, I'm ready to put my neck on the guillotine.
Okay.
For that.
All right. I've worked, probably about 20, 30 minutes on ranging things. So I think they're easier to find and more clearly defined. In answer to what Eugene said about times and so forth, Eugene, there are a couple of files in there under the educational material that have nothing but links on them, okay? And they are links to videos and articles and so forth. Now, on the videos, I have made a point of putting a heading on as to what they're about and also giving the amount of the time. So you can look at them and you can see whether it's a 90-minute video or a 4-minute video or whatever it is. And also, if the title of the video isn't clear, I put a little explanation of what it is. So I've been trying to do that with the links. The articles, I how many pages or anything. Some of them might indicate they're short or long or something, but not anything beyond that. But anyway, I am cognizant of people wanting to know how much time they're going to be spending on things. And and I end up putting most of them in there because somebody sends them in on the listserv and doesn't put them in the document. So I turn around and put them in the document. So I'll watch for that. And if they're, short or long or 5 pages or 3 pages or whatever, I'll indicate that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I think all of us, as we go to Google Docs, if we find something that needs to be straightened up or labeled better and that kind of thing, or something that we read and it's not labeled like that, to just fix it, when you're there, might help also.
Yeah, well, sometimes when you name the documents, you can't see the whole name, it cuts off the back end of it. So some of them I actually renamed to put is something in the front of the label so that you know what it is.
Know what it is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. A little challenging sometimes.
And just, tidying up, like you straighten up your house, which I don't do very often, but.
Eugene.
Yeah, Eugene.
Before the night is over, can you put on the agenda someplace a short report from Sue about her trip And then she might want to follow up at a following meeting with a more in-depth report. But I would like to hear some of her initial reaction. Over.
Yeah, we will do that, Eugene. In fact, I had asked her to write a report after she gets back. And I'm not going to ask her to give us a report tonight because she's been traveling all day. Okay. So we'll give her a rest, and she can give us a report next week, unless she wants to give us a report.
I think she is fired up, and she would be happy to give us a short report.
I'd be happy to give a short report and then follow up with more content.
Okay. Okay.
Good. Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Very good. I'm anxious to hear.
You want to do it right now, or you want to wait till next week?
Well, I can do a short 5-minute.
Fresh off the plane.
Okay. So one of the high points was that Professor Joseph Huber, who is a monetary reformer from Germany and very well respected in the international movement for monetary reform, and has spoken a number of times, come to Chicago and spoken at the American Monetary Institute, and he's someone I can always email and ask questions of, and he's very down to earth. He'll answer them right away. Very helpful. So he came, and he gave around an hour talk about MMT. And he was not oblique. He said that they were a false flag operation twice. I mean, and he gave details and everything. And then I followed up. He gave that talk to the whole group. There's around 40 to 50 people there. And then I followed up with to a smaller group, because we had broken up into different groups at that point. But I had around, I guess, 10 to 15 people. And I went through the slides that I gave at the American Monetary Institute last fall with the history of MMT and the Green Party. And people really got it. In fact, Dr. Huber came up to me afterwards. He said, "I really want your slides because it's a good example." Because in Europe, they don't have a sense of MMT, you know. Overall, there are certain countries like Italy. I know they've gone to at one point and MMT, but so that was important, because a lot of the people, I just don't, in Europe, just don't know about MMT. You know, they don't know what to think about it. So that was very good. And
some don't.
What, Howard? Did you say something?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
I can't hear.
I started to, but then I didn't want to interrupt. And someone else is saying something, I thought.
But that reminds me.
I was just saying.
That reminds me. We sang, the whole group of us sang two of Howard's songs.
Right.
It was great. Because they had,
all right.
I had the music.
I was wondering.
Yeah. We played the music with Howard singing, and I put the words up on the, you know, displayed them from the computer, and everybody sang it. We sang a new kind of money, and anthem,
great.
The Alliance Anthem. It was great.
Yeah.
It was great. People liked it. And then, you
right.
know, I had my own,
fine.
I had my own revelations. You know, I went to the small groups, different topics, and I was getting to know how people were thinking in the monetary reform movement in Europe. And there was one woman there from South Africa. I wasn't sure because I hadn't met people before, but in the small groups you get a chance to not only listen, but you can ask questions and get responses. And what I realized early on was that the Europeans in this group, they don't really have a sense of the history of public money, and it affects their thinking, you know. And I had my thoughts clarified by being able to listen and then say things to them, and I realized, you know, this is so funny. They're dealing with trying to figure out about central banking, right? There was one workshop, how independent is a central bank? That's the topic. And you know what I realized, and I spoke up and people, they appreciated it. You know, our history, our public money comes direct from the treasury. We don't go through a fucking central bank, you know, the greenbacks,
right.
You know, the colonial money,
yeah.
The continentals, you know, there's no, and
yeah.
Like the NEED Act, there's no reason to have a central bank, right? And so
right.
That was really interesting for me. That helped me clarify, you know, and I think it has to do with they don't have the history of the public money, you know. So that was exciting for me. I learned a lot from that about my thinking. And
yeah.
And there was one Edgar Wortman. He's he's from
Netherlands.
The Netherlands. You know, I can never remember the name of that country. Is it Holland? Is it Dutch? Is it Netherlands? And he was giving a workshop. I think he was giving the workshop, I forget which one, maybe the independence of the central bank or whatever. And he was talking about Arnsgeld, which is his Netherlands, he's a member of the Netherlands Monetary Reform Group, Arnsgeld, and they've had made connections with their parliament, and they've done a lot of work, public. But I asked him, from what he was talking about, I said, well, are you interested in educating your public? Because it didn't feel to me that the energy was going all into connecting with the administration and this and that. I said, well, are you trying to educate the public? And his response was, not at this point. And I was kind of shocked. I just assume if you're a monetary reformer, you want to educate your public, you know. So that was interesting, you know.
Didn't they have a play that was popular that kind of exposed the issue?
Yes, that was the original.
Wasn't, and then it got
that was at the, that
uh-huh.
was at the beginning of their organization.
And that started the talk with their parliament.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, they're part of the EU, and they're... They use the euro, right?
Yes.
So they don't have their own central bank. They have the EU bank.
Well, they all have their central banks, but the power is in the European central bank.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they can't decide
they're just subordinate to.
Right.
The ECB. Okay.
So that's
great, Sue. Yeah. Look forward to hearing more.
Good.
All right.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank
You're
you.
Welcome.
Yeah. Now, Eugene had a let's see, what have we got next on our agenda here? We did the website.
Talking points for candidates.
Talking points for candidates. Rita and Kevin both submitted drafts. They were both good. But I favored Rita's because I felt like it connected in more basic language. But I think they might both be good because people that are a little bit more technical might appreciate it. But anyway, I haven't had a chance to do anything.
I would make a suggestion on that. If you would like, maybe Kevin and I can collaborate on the two documents, and he can fix what he thinks is wrong with mine, and I can fix what I think is wrong with his. Kevin,
all
would
right,
that be
good.
All right with you?
Sure.
Okay. I already made some comments years, but I wasn't done. And so then after we get them all fixed up, maybe by next week, we can have everybody else look at them, if we need to do that.
Yes, and I would like to keep a copy of the original, if you don't mind, of each of those, as well as your new revised versions.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll try to remember to do that. So,
all right.
It's kind of hard to work on a Google Doc and keep the original, but we'll work on it.
Yeah, I think you have to print a PDF or something like that.
I don't remember what Kevin uploaded. I probably uploaded a Word document or something and then converted it to a Google Doc. So my original's probably there. I don't know if Kevin did that. I'll have to look. If not, I can make a copy of Kevin's and put it on a Word file or something.
Okay.
I'll make a note to do that.
Okay.
To save our regionals.
Charlotte, are you getting much out of all this? Is this all fascinating to you, I hope?
It's very interesting. I can't say that I understand everything that everybody's talking about, but...
Okay. Well, I think we're going to get into that. If we're getting into Eugene's thing on this... modern monetary promotional effort. Is that what we're going to talk about here in just a minute?
Yeah. Well, I think Eugene had some questions.
Yeah.
About it. And so, but I don't know what those are. So, Eugene, did you want to present your questions on this article that you read?
I would like to start. If there are some people who haven't seen the article, it was in Bloomberg Business Week this week, March 25th issue, and it was 3 pages of print and 1 full page of an elaborate diagram of economists starting in the 1600s to the present, and they had and this diagram was based on a new book that one of the MMT promoters had written, an Australian economist, and it's 573 pages long. And so the article is somewhat a summary of their position, along with some criticisms that some economists have made. What I found particularly interesting in the article was a graph, and that was on
One moment. I just have to find the graph. I think it was on page 43. And it, I have the paper version, and I transmitted to the group the email version or the electronic version. And in the paper version, it's in green, and it shows that there were about, the designation is cash in circulation. It doesn't say whether it's the U.S. or the world, but I'm pretty sure it's the U.S. Cash in circulation plus banks reserves in the Federal Reserve. So it's, I think, yes, if you go to page 30, excuse me, you will find that graph, and it might be helpful to go there. But that's the article you can see. That's the giant diagram. And but that graph shows that there was only about 400, I have to get my units here. The graph lists $4 trillion in assets within cash in circulation and the reserves in the Federal Reserve. Yes, that's it. So you see how 2008 is about the middle, because to the left is 2000 and the right is the current time, 2019. So right in the middle is 2007. So all this black area, huge cloud, you know, like an A-bomb, is what the Federal Reserve has done since the financial crisis in 2007, 2008. This is gives you an indication of the way they have just created a tremendous expansion in the money supply. And it has profound consequences for people all around the world, and particularly in the United States. All that money now is chasing profits. And there aren't enough profitable things. You know, they're not willing to accept 2% profit. You know, they're looking for 10, 15, 20% profit. And so they're all these groups are scrambling. And, you know, they're the Ubers of the world. You know, they're trying to disrupt the economy and so forth, and all kinds of industries.
It's all in the speculative economy.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right.
And so this is an example of what financialization means. And the article before it in Bloomberg, this graph is, you have to pay about $20,000 a year to get on the Bloomberg terminals. But and those terminals, they can create all these kinds of graphs from all the data they have, within the computers that are compiling all this financial and industrial information and so forth. But the in the previous article, and it was about CalPERS, which is the California Insurance for Public Employees, and they are now contributing, because they're trying to increase their rate of profit to pay the members their pension funds in California, they have put a portion of their money into private equity, which is a Wall Street game in which, you buy a corporation cheaply, you dismember it, you fire a lot of workers, you lay off others, you speed up the remaining workers, and then, after you've taken it private, then you eventually make it public, and you kill units of it and so forth. I mean, it's devastating to workers. And Mitt Romney is, and his Bain company is one of the chief examples of what private equity means. But that that graph to me was very helpful in explaining, I think, I haven't completely thought it through, but explaining how the financialization of the United States and the creation of this speculative bubble, speculative money, creates absolute havoc in the economy, and especially in a crisis period, which may be upon us, you know, as we face a business downturn in the near future and then the consequences of that. But so that was one example of this article that I thought was helpful.
Joe's on the stack.
It has nothing to do with MMT.
They have a comment on that.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
I see.
Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Okay. So yeah, I want to make sure that Eugene understands the graph that he was looking at was really the change in the Fed's assets. You know, that's what it really was. And then the amount of cash and the other, you know, the other component is the central bank's reserve. Okay? That is to say the reserves that are issued by the central bank. And of course, what happened in 2008 with the central bank is that they swapped reserves of their own making for the assets, some of the assets that were being held by the bank that were in danger of, well, they were just in, you know, they were in danger of everything, you know, going bad. And so they swapped them out and they gave the bank the central bank reserves. Central bank reserves are not money in the sense that they don't circulate in the economy as they're interbank media. And having them in circulation for the banking industry is a tremendous boost. Okay, it's the settlement media by which the banks loans and accounts with each other are settled. And so they have, it's like they have money, but it's not like we have money. It's not like we have money that we could do anything with, like for instance, if the money supply. So that graph is not a graph of the money supply increase, it's a graph of the bank reserve increase. And those are the assets of the Federal Reserve bank system, and their liabilities, they're in circulation. And you know, when quantitative easing, that's the quantitative easing really right there that was happening. That's the bubble that quantitative easing bubble. And when that happened, it happened after they went down to 0% interest rate, and they had no place else to go, so they just were doing everything to try to save the banking system from failing. And that was the move that Fed made. That was, you know, Bernanke's brilliant move there, and it did save the bank. It gave the banks wiggle room. It didn't really. In order for the money supply to be expanded, the banks had to use that. The boost that they got in that settlement media to make loans. That is to say, to have their position to make them afford to be able to make loans. And then the money supply did increase, indeed. And all of that is indeed what Eugene said, which is an indication of the result of the financialization of the economy, that more and more of the money that is created and goes into circulation goes into a financial transaction where assets of private people are built up and held, and there's no money that goes into either production or wage, either economic production of stuff to buy or wages, especially, which would be income for people to pay their bills and their debt. So we have in that kind of a separation within the monetary economy that all the money is going to the bubbles of assets, and from there making money for the 1%, whereas the other side is getting less and less of the money supply and getting further and further into debt. So anyway, I just want to make sure that I would like to try to make sure somehow that Eugene understands what that chart is. Okay, it's not a chart of the money supply. Okay, there are other charts that show that, but that's a chart of the assets of the Fed that have been in circulation. And that line that goes to 2000, if it kept going out to the left, would stay relatively the same, you know, for the 20, 30 years before that. That is to say, there have been increases, but the increases happen after each recession. After each crash, recession, however big they are, then the Fed has to have more assets out there in order to keep the house of cards going. Over.
Kevin Stagg.
It was a big correction. All right, Kevin.
Yeah, just some more commentary on that thing there. Let's see. I addressed this in that video that I did on the Federal Reserve, and I'm looking for the little slide. But basically what happened was all of these the mortgage bonds, where the banks would pool the mortgages and sell bonds and stuff like that. And they had all of these liar loan bonds, or ninja mortgages, as they called them. And they were not good debts. They were not good mortgages, but they were on their books at a value of, you know, like yeah. whatever the house sold for. Yeah. So the Federal Reserve, and so this is what happened, was that nobody wanted these bank mortgages, and since these banks had these bank mortgages, nobody believed the accounts of that bank, and they wouldn't accept their paper for overnight paper or for seller financing. What do they call it? Where you have all these deposits that are made all around the world, and banks are guaranteeing payment. You know, it's a commercial paper, that's what it's called. Okay, so this is all a note debt system that where the debts are very short term in the commercial paper stuff. But because the banks issuing the commercial paper had the mortgage loans as their assets, and the mortgage loans were obviously fraud, nobody wanted their paper anymore. So the financial crisis it's just kind of how the whole thing ballooned. But what Joe said, that basically what happened, the Federal Reserve issued money to the banks that had these bad mortgages and simply bought the mortgages at face value. So a bank that had issued, $1 billion of fraudulent mortgages, the Federal Reserve paid $1 billion for it. And so those are on the books of the Federal Reserve, and they are, I think, the largest mortgage holder in the United States. I think that's true. It's one of those facts that you can verify. I mean, I know it's been said, and all they're doing is they're collecting the payments on the mortgages. And I don't know if they're foreclosing on people or what, or if they work behind the scenes. You know, like they farm it out, and there'll be some agency that does it for them. I'm trying to find my graph on this, because there was another point I wanted to make, that even though that graph appears to have shot up, you know, from a very low amount to have shot up a lot, it actually follows a compounding curve pretty closely, and it's in that paper. And where the heck, there it is. Okay, I have this list of stuff here. Where is it? Okay, I'm not going to share my screen on this. But anyway, it's because then you'll know how many programs I have open. No, I'm just
calling the kettle black. Okay.
Okay. All right. Let me see if I can do this here. It's okay. All right, let me see how I can do this. I'll try to share this. It's not exactly the same. I mean, you'll recognize it. And share. Okay, share.
Share okay. Screen and then pick the thing you're sharing.
Yeah. okay.
And if right, you've got several things.
All right, let's see what's happening here. Is it doing it?
It's doing it, I think. It's trying to, but we're just a blank screen right now.
That's what I'm saying.
Did you click on the picture that you wanted?
I thought so.
Well, we've got a blank screen here, so.
Yeah, all right. Stop share. Sorry, guys. My program is a little bit funny. Okay, but I'll describe it to you. My computer, you know, Zoom is a little funny. I use Linux, and Zoom is a little bit funny on mine. So it's working better. I have to have these other programs loaded that, anyway, basically what happens is the Federal Reserve base money supply follows a compounding rate of 6.6% from 1960, and it kind of starts dropping off in the 1990s. It doesn't keep up with it in the 1990s. And then it's almost flattening out, like it's not keeping up at all. And then in 2008, it starts going straight up, and it gets way up above it. But the nature of exponential growth is that, you know, the curve is rising constantly. So within the next 10 years, it will be back on track with this compounded growth, assuming that they don't do another quantitative easing. And, you know, but the only reason they had to do that was to buy all these mortgages. So now the banks have all of sound credit because instead of fraudulent mortgages, they now have treasury bills and stuff like that. And so it boomed the stock market because that's what the banks and the Wall Street guys play with. And it's also boomed real estate markets. But the thing I want to address is that there's this stuff here which I believe everyone gets tied up in believing in all these systems and data and checking all this stuff, and they ignore this basic thing which I think that that Paul is probably more sensitive to, and that is just the system we have where money is created by monetizing a debt. You go to the bank and you borrow money. The bank says, "Oh, you're a good guy, and we're going to loan you money." So they create the money, and it's an asset to them. And it's a deposit in your account. And so it's basically your parents giving you tokens. You know, that's the same kind of thing. You know, here you're a good kid, and you get your little whatever, star points or whatever. So what the banks then do is they have a payment system, and the tokens from the Bank of America are perfectly well accepted at the Chase Bank, and they're also perfectly accepted at the Citibank, and perfectly accepted at all of the banks in the Federal Reserve System. And, you know, and it's a network effect that when you have a powerful network, everybody wants to join it because everybody can see the advantage to them of belonging to it. So it's all this mutual thing of everybody accepting everybody else's tokens in the payment system. And so the mutuality is where the person who's borrowing the money is going to do something good with it, and the bank is supporting them by providing, you know, access to this this network, this payment network. And that's kind of gone by the wayside. You know, what you have are greedy people manipulating the system, and their objective is to suck as much out as possible. So this creates the fraudulent mortgages because it wasn't the banks, it was the people who run the banks. It was the executives and the consultants and other people who feed off the system that they could pay themselves bonuses, commissions, fees, etc., from doing these mortgages. And the bank was an institution whose books could be manipulated to cover up the malfeasance for as long as possible. And so that is what happens. That's what our system has kind of degenerated into. I think I went a long way to make that point. But so much of this discussion and this article that Eugene talks about in the New York Times, to me, is a quintessential example of talking about everything except what really matters. So.
Janice Stack.
Okay. Go ahead, Janice.
I'm out.
I can only conclude that all of this mortgage discussion has to lead to affordable housing and making housing available to our people who desperately need it from a Green Party point of view. So that's all I want to say on that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and the public money's just gonna help do that a lot.
Eugene Stack.
History shows that what they did with it. Go ahead, Eugene.
I have a question about the article. I'll read from one paragraph toward the end. Critics of MMT reject its reassurance that a country with its own currency does not need to worry about deficits. After all, it's been proven that a nation that loses the confidence of the world's investors will see its currency plummet. I think deficits are important, and I think they have consequences. And I wonder what, especially in an international context, U.S. deficits and the use of the dollar as a reserve currency in the world has a great deal of implications in terms of funding in the defense industry, etc. And I would like to ask other people what their opinion about this is, and what you think MMT claims over.
Joe Stack.
Go ahead, Joe.
Well, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so Eugene, you know, they use words, okay, they say countries and governments, okay? And they talk about them being, you know, sovereign in their currency and those kinds of things. And then they imply from that government controls the money. And
yes.
And whereas it represents the potential for the government to control the money, there isn't any country in the world right now whose government controls its money. Okay, all of the countries in the world use the central banking system that we do, in which private banks, through the fractional reserve bank, issue all the money. So for them to say anything like, I actually don't remember if that was included in my note to one of the authors. And you probably didn't get this either, Eugene, okay? But one of the authors of that Bloomberg article was at the Eastern Economics Association meeting where myself and Howie Hawkins and Jamie Walton and others, Sue, spoke in New York City. And she contacted me after the meeting, after the gathering, and we exchanged some information about MMT. Obviously, I didn't strike any major chords with her. But when that article came out, and I wrote to her about it, you know, and I said, you know, there's a lot of fallacies that are hidden behind both well-sounding and well-thought-out phrases and statements that need to be understood and examined. I took one of the quotes from the article in which it said that, you know, that part of their belief is that it's not a problem for the government to borrow, not a problem for any government that issues its own money, that issues its own currency, that issues debt in its own currency, et cetera, to borrow, because that country can always issue the money. Issue, print actually is the word they use. They can always print the money to pay for the interest that's due on those debts, okay? And I wrote to her and I said, well, what sense does it make? What logic is there being applied if they can create and print the money to pay the interest, then they can create and print the money to pay for the spending that they're borrowing the money for. So you guys are not thinking, you know, this thing through. And I wrote in there, the only response I got was, thanks, Joe, okay? But in fact, that's the main curveball that comes at the people. people in the world who don't understand the monetary system. The main curveball from MFT comes with the word that. T-H-A-T, the word that, okay? A government that creates its own currency and issues its own currency and issues debt only in its own currency cannot go insolvent. That's what they say. But who is that government? It's certainly not our government. It's certainly not any government that I know of. So then the question becomes, why do they say it that way? To me, they say it that way in order to mislead us about the nature of how they're trying to carry on the banking and money system, which is they want to keep the banking and money system that we have now. Over.
Right. False flag.
False flag.
Oh. Almost literally.
Alfred Stack.
Sue Stack.
Yeah, Alfred.
Yeah, it's kind of like, okay, they can't go insolvent, but basically that implies that someone is actually buying or borrowing to use that currency. Well, if there's no market for the currency because other people, other investors, other banks don't think it's worth anything, then, you know, sure, it's not insolvent, but it's like it has no value. In other words, there's no foreign value. Maybe there's a domestic value, but, you know, it's worth less than something that would be publicly traded, or it would be worth less than something that people are wanting to keep as a reserve currency because it has some stability to it. Over.
Yes.
Okay. And we had Sue.
Right. I just want to explain something to some of the people that are new to the committee. And interpreting data, you know, the money supply, etc. I usually go to the St. Louis Fed website because they give pretty good financial data and they graph it. So I just want to say this. Okay, so every time a commercial bank makes a loan, they create the money that we all use. So I just went to Fred and I looked for mortgages. Now, mortgages are loans that banks give, and they're big loans, and they come with a lot of interest. And my understanding from the past was that most of our money supply, again created by banks when they make loans, is made from mortgage loans because they're big loans. So I just want to share my screen because I was surprised to go and look at the amount of mortgage loans given by private commercial banks. So I'm just going to share this. Share. Okay. Because it was a little bit surprising for me. Okay. What do I want to share? Oh, here. Can everyone see that?
Almost. Yeah.
Okay. So this is what the St. Louis Fed, St. Louis Regional Bank, this is what they displayed for mortgage debt outstanding. Again, remember, every loan a commercial bank makes, they create the money. So they have created, and this is in on the left, it's in millions of dollars. So the top number is 16 trillion. It's starting at the bottom from zero up to 16 trillion. So it's interesting that, you know, in the 50s and the 60s, people made enough income, earned enough income, that they didn't have to take out large mortgages. They could, the houses were not that costly. They could put in a big substantial down payment and take a little mortgage and 10, 15 years pay it off. But of course that's changed because people's incomes have gone down and they've had to get into more and more personal debt to support their families. So if you follow this amount of mortgage debt and you get to 2008, you can see it dipped down, right? Because we had the crisis and people were walking away from their mortgages and houses. But now look at it's sort of starting up again. I'm really surprised. I didn't have to...
That's right. That's right. They didn't learn anything, and or actually they did learn something. They learned that they could transfer a lot of wealth to themselves. I wanted to note that the shaded lines that you see on the graph, those are recessions. That's how often the monetary system breaks down.
Yes. Yes. But who's buying the mortgages? Who's going into debt to the banks? And, I mean, the banks have
to keep... The market is still high.
Think of it this way. The banks have to keep those mortgages, right? Because that's our money supply. That's the bulk of our money supply, is these big mortgages. They're creating...
Right.
Creating that. I don't know. I can't figure it out.
Well, a lot of that is in the speculative
right.
economy, too, though.
It is, yeah.
Oh, you mean people who
not
have...
Not in the real economy. Not where we get it.
Oh, you mean like...
Read it, Stack.
Like investors that have gone to the banks to get mortgages to buy homes that they're going to keep for investment purposes?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh.
That's one factor.
And what they did is, you know, when all these houses were going into foreclosure or whatever, these investors went in and bought them all up and jacked the rent up everywhere.
But you mean they bought them with mortgage debt?
True.
This is mortgage debt.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so then, the people that lost their homes to foreclosure then ended up having to pay rent to these folks that bought up all these homes that went into foreclosure.
Oh, that's interesting. Wow.
And one of the biggest corporations doing that is the company. I think it's Blackstone. The founder, et cetera, is Schwartz. Mark or something like that.
Wow.
Big Wall Street guy. And they in places like Las Vegas, they swooped in Arizona and other places and literally bought tremendous stretches. And now there's even some criticism of Blackstone because now they're considered not slum landlords, but exploitive landlords, the biggest exploitive landlords in the world.
Mm. Wow.
The wages of usury.
Okay.
But thank you very much for the graph, because I think we have to use graphs like this in our outreach. Not only cartoons,
yeah,
but graphs that right, we're trying to shock people with, and when we explain it, I think... I hope it would have an effect. Over.
Rita Stack.
Yeah, Rita.
I reminded me, I wanted to tell everybody that Howard uploaded a whole bunch of cartoons and such things under, what we call that, graphs and marketing,
I think.
What is it?
Can't remember now.
Anyway, marketing is in the title of it. It's something in marketing or marketing in something. And it's mainly full of Howard's cartoons. However, I did upload some of my own graphs and things into that folder.
Okay.
And I try to, you know, if I do trifolds or whatever, I generally try to put graphs, pictures, et cetera, things in them that help explain things. And
yeah.
I would like, at some point, I'll probably try to make some trifolds as we get into doing more of these educational things.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm so good at PowerPoint presentations and those kind of things, but I can certainly make some trifolds.
Okay, cool.
Eugene Stack?
Yeah, Eugene?
I have one last question from this article, and I wonder if people could help me with it. The Federal Reserve, MMT's detractors are skeptical of the idea that the Treasury and Central Bank should work in concert. The Federal Reserve did the Treasury Department's bidding during World War II, but that, and then in quotes, overdraft privilege was used spottily thereafter and permanently ended in 1981, precisely because economists warned that a subservient central bank would allow inflation to race out of control. I mean, the issue of 1981 is the Reagan era, and Volcker is head of the Fed, and you know that was one of the changes. But I never heard this as ending a policy that existed since World War II. That's new to me. Over.
Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, you know what they're trying to do there is to equate money creation with the overdraft facility at the Fed, okay, and the overdraft facility at the Fed is more like you know running out of money in your bank account overnight, and you know having to have money there in the morning. It's not like money creation, okay? It was put there for the purpose of just ensuring that all of the demands of the war were going to be able to be met without any question, in case there was a glitch in the accounting or whatever. And so it was an expediency, provision. So it's not like we did nothing to limit the power of the government or extend the power of the government to create money by closing that that provision, and it was used very sparingly, and certainly since the war was only used for overnight until they repealed it. So it's not a big deal, but they try to make a big deal of it because what they're trying to do is to convince people that the government. This is their how their thing about how money is created, that the Congress instructs the Federal Reserve to pay into the account of the Treasury for the programs that it creates. Okay, now that's the construct that they are trying to advance and to get you to understand. And I'm going to repeat it: that the Congress, in its authorization for spending, is authorizing the Federal Reserve to create the money and to put it into the bank of into the account of the Treasury. Now that is, nothing could be further from the truth than that. Okay? Nothing could be further from the truth. But they're trying to sell it with the fancy language that they're using, which is just being repeated in that article. And quite frankly, I am absolutely sure I will be sending Katya a note about that as well. Because I did not really read the whole article when I wrote to her. I only read a part of it, and I only you know, use one quote and left it at that. But obviously, but that's part of the confusion. That's part of what looks to be trying to clarify something that might be important to try to get you to think that there's any other issue out there besides who creates the money. And there isn't any other issue out there. The issue is who creates the money and gains from it and benefits from it. That should be the people. And the way they're trying to do is to say, well, there's not really anything wrong with this system. All we need to do is to give it a chance to, you know, to work with.
Right, and it's the government's fault.
Yes.
Sue Stack.
Janice.
Is it fair to conclude that inflation is created by a profit-creating system?
I'm sorry, that kind of broke up. I didn't hear that.
Is it fair to conclude that inflation is created by a profit-creating system?
Kevin Stack, I would say yes.
Sure, thank you.
Certainly this one.
Yep.
Paul Stack?
Yeah, Paul.
I think that it's important in this to disaggregate profit. There are two kinds of profit. One is in a small business such as mine. I just have my own private business. My income for the work that I do is profit. As an organization gets larger, it creeps into a situation of unearned income, which is gotten by the organization. And this unearned income is a very different kind of profit than the kind of profit which I make. But one of the things that is done by the fact that profit is not disaggregated is that all profit is looked at as legitimate income for people, and it is not.
Right. Yeah.
Kevin Stack.
Kevin.
Okay, you know, a couple of points that I want to comment on. One was the question about inflation being created for profit. Well, inflation, I just like to say, and I try to make this point in my video, which I'm still working on, but it should be on the website so people could look at it, and I'm still hoping for comments on it because it has all these graphs and stuff that really, all these articles have a lot of the same material. I didn't see the articles before I put it in. But I think that, you know, if that thing could be done good, I think it would be a good article, a good video for it. But anyway, one of the points I try to make is that this inflation, you know, if you notice, and I can't, I don't have the information to connect all the dots, but back in, it was like before the financial crisis, but a Goldman Sachs alumni was appointed Treasury Secretary in Canada. And then Goldman Sachs gets appointed in all these places. And, you know, there was the thing about it being actually government Sachs. And they've had their people appointed everywhere. But if you watch, I mean, to me, it's not just a bunch of guys in a club getting good jobs. They have an agenda, and they all know how to do it. If you watch a Goldman Sachs, and I unfortunately come to the realization, you know, well after the fact, so I can't, like, put the facts and figures together. But what I'm saying is it just seems to me, if you watch, they get appointed, and then shortly thereafter, a bubble starts developing, typically in real estate. So they know how to get the bids and stuff going in real estate to start getting the prices going up. And they know how to structure the bank lending to keep it going. But the inflation, is important. And Janice made the point about affordable housing and things like that. But the inflation is essential because the bank is loaning money. Let's suppose the bank loans me money for a house and I can barely afford it. I'm really reaching, but you know, everybody's given me a little contribution and I've got this and that and I can barely make the payment. And I'm doing that. Well, you know, if that's your business, which it would be for most people, for bank lending, people just barely being able to afford their mortgage. If that was the bank lending, you know, that would be kind of a tough business because bad things happen. And when you're loaning out, you know, large sums of money and you're only collecting 4 or 5% interest and you have a loan go bad, that wipes out the interest off of how many other loans. You know, you have to take that loss and put it as a charge on your accounts and all that. It's not like they actually lose money because they never had the money, you know, they created the money, but their accounting system, they really do have to honor the rules of their accounting system. So the banks need inflation in order to be sure that the loans get paid. So if I buy my house and I'm struggling to make payments and all that, and it's all well and good, you know, the fact that I can't really afford to keep it up in the greatest shape and that I might not be able to sell it for more than I bought it for, except the banks take care of that by causing the inflation. So then my house goes up and I start thinking, this is really neat. I've made all this profit on my house and I can sell it for 10% more than I paid for it. But, you know, all I'm thinking about is the money I made. But the fact of the matter is the bank is able to have a much more solid credit. While this property bubble is inflating, all of these banks are able to make more loans. The loans are always paid. The quality, according to their standard, goes up. And they get more fees, more commissions, more, et cetera. And so this is why you have property bubbles. And this is one of the main things, is that as prices go up, the loans look better to the banks. And, you know, these are not benevolent institutions. A bank is basically a big accounting system that is run by a bunch of lecherous parasites. I think that's a better understanding of it than anything else. But anyway, so I just wanted to make that point that all these things serve a purpose in the banking system and in the way that it's organized. I mean, it's not by accident and it's not out of any good, intention that things are organized the way they are.
I agree, Kevin.
Sustack.
And I think the other end. Okay, Sue.
No, go ahead.
But I think the other end of what you were talking about is the bust. You know, there's the bubble and then there's the bust. And of course,
and that's why it's so important. That's why it's so important that they don't put their own money in.
That's right. And so you've got all these big loans, then they stop lending and it crashes.
Kevin, when you made the comment that the banks are run by lecherous parasites. Joe put here in the chat box, can I quote you on that, Kevin?
Yeah.
Well, that will certainly add to the people's impression. They'll be like, oh,
okay,
I will know something.
I think I'm the only one that caught it, so I wanted to share it. So I didn't want Joe's effort to go in vain.
Yeah. All right, Sue, you had a comment.
Yes, I wanted to reply to Eugene. He was asking for trying to understand the relationship between the Treasury of the United States and the Reserve Bank and the Reserve Bank supporting the Treasury with money. I have a paper that Jamie Walton from the American Monetary Institute sent out. He found this. This is a paper written by an economist at the Fed. I'm going to share, just so you see what it looks like here, bed paper. Okay. Let me know when you can see my screen.
Okay.
Okay. So this is the paper, and I'll put it up on the Google Doc wherever you tell me to do it. But it's cool. Direct purchases of U.S. Treasury securities by Federal Reserve banks. And the man's name is Kenneth Garbad. And he wrote it in August of 2014. And it's a staff report.
Yeah.
From the New York Fed. And he gives, it's very well written. He gives the history of the legal, the law that, about this.
Oh, but I just good. Was,
yes, it's very, very well written. And I hadn't known any of this history before. I just knew the current law, but it goes back to the changes from the original Federal Reserve Law of 1913 and the changes mm-hmm. that went through it. But I just want to say that what's difficult about understanding the paper, it's not that he's not a good writer. The difficulty comes when you try to understand the nature of the Treasury account and the nature of the Federal Reserve account, because both accounts are in reserves. And it's a little difficult because you have to say reserves are in the Federal Reserve Bank and we don't use them. The people don't use them. But the loans the banks make create the money we use in our money supply. And they don't intermingle. But what you have to keep in your head is that the Treasury account is actually in the New York Fed Bank and is reserves, full of reserves. So just to say that.
Yeah, Joe.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this, you know, comes down to wanting to really understand the relationship between the two bodies, the governmental body of the Treasury, our Treasury, and the Federal Reserve Bank system, the Federal Reserve system, and the role that they play being the fiscal agent for the Treasury, serving as the central bank of the country. But there's still the private, you know, a private institution that is doing that.
Yeah.
And to me, in seeking to understand that relationship from the perspective of the public, the best explanation that I have found is in the Department of Treasury's annual report. And I know that several people on this committee have referred to several of the Treasury's annual report. And in there, in the footnotes to the financial statement, is a note by the Treasury about its relationship with the Federal Reserve System. And I implore everyone to seek that out and to read it and to understand it, because it's very clear what the relationship is from reading that note. You know, it's in the notes to the, it's in the accounting note number 1, I think, and it's the notes to the financial statement, notes accompanying the financial statement of the Treasury, and it's been the same note for, you know, a number of years, but it states in there, and the only place that I know of anywhere where the Treasury states what its relationship with the Federal Reserve System is and how it functions as our Treasury with using that Federal Reserve System to pay our bills. Over.
Joe, could you give us a send out an email with that reference? Because I'd really like to look it up.
Sure, I will.
Thank you. Thank you.
Janice Beck.
Go ahead, Janice.
Me too. Thank you for requesting that, Gigi. Also, I'm going to have to sign off, so I wanted to let you guys know I'm on the road right now from Austin back to Houston, and I really can't get off the phone. So, I think it's been an amazing call, and I'm going to look forward to reviewing it and, you know, doing the study that goes along with that for the things that we're talking about.
Good night, Janice.
Good night.
Actually, it's 11:04 in least in Michigan.
I'm moved that we do adjourn.
I'll second that. Okay, that's good. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Good discussion.
Yeah, been good.
Thank you. Good night, y'all.
Good night. Glad I'm back, too.
Hey.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, all.